I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, I have a thought or two about that controversial public service ad on BET. But first, it's time for Wisdom Watch, our conversation with leaders who've gone before us, people with experience and knowledge, not just smart, but wise. Today, we talk to Marva Collins. She opened a one-room school in her home after becoming fed up with what existing schools had to offer children, including her own. From that room, she became known as a woman who could teach the kids other people could not. Thousands of students have now passed through her doors, and schools following her methods have opened across the country. Her daughter now runs the school she founded, but Dr. Collins still has a lot to say. Marva Collins joins us now from her home in South Carolina. Welcome. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Now, I'm sure you've been asked this a million times, but I'd like to know, how did you get started as a teacher? Was it something you really felt a calling to do, or was it one of those fields that was open to African-American women at the time?
I think from the time I was a young child, I always wanted to play school growing up in Alabama, and if I couldn't be the teacher, I didn't want to play. And during those times, the adult population, many of them had never learned to read. So I would go from house to house when I was about 7 or 8, reading their mail from their relatives in the north for them. My parents and grandparents were business people, and I would open the business mail and circle what I thought were errors and send them back to the people.
I'm sure that was appreciated.
I just have always been curious, and I've always loved reading. I would travel to different countries, and I actually kept a pretend travel log after I read about a certain country. I would write in the travel log that I had visited there and the things I had seen and that kind of thing.
So you always had sort of a vision of the world being bigger than the one you were in.
Well, I think that made me really almost very different from the kids that grew up in Alabama, because I was constantly told by my peers, don't you know that you're a black child or black girl and you can't do that? But I kept pictures of the house I was going to have one day. I would keep pictures. I would read the home magazines and places I was going to visit. And I kept a journal from the time I was 10, and I have done everything in that journal except two things.
What were the two things?
To have a house in the south of France, and to one day get enough monies to open a school and take all of the children that no one wants and that we have asserted cannot achieve and show what they can be.
Don't you think you've come close? Except for that south of France part, but...
Well, I'm never really satisfied. I just weep for our children. There was an article, I think, in Time magazine about geniuses. And only one or two minority children were mentioned in that article. I think the expectation, especially for inner city children, the expectations are very, very low.
You think it's still that way?
Well, I think it's still that way, that excellence is just not expected of our children.
I wanted to go back to the beginning when you first started your school. You had been a Chicago public school teacher. What was it that you were seeing that made you feel that it just wasn't working, that just wasn't enough, and you could do better?
Well, after 14 years in the public school, the principal constantly, I transferred to 3 different schools. And it finally dawned on me that wherever I went, my expectations were always higher. I've had a principal say to me, your problem is you can't close your door and forget that these are not your children and that you expect too much from these students. And I just, again, became very, very frustrated at the low expectations for the students, or I was considered out of my mind to even believe that children in the public school in the inner city could understand the classics and appreciate them.
What do you think you did that was so different from what other schools were doing at the time? Because it wasn't just the public schools. It was the private schools, too, that you had some disappointment with.
But I think, again, it's my readings of the great teachers like Comenius, Quintilian, are the great teachers of the past, Aristotle, Plato, who really never came with the attitude that students were inferior. I think I find the best. I began with children, even in kindergarten, teaching them the world of ideas from Aristotle, where we each begin with a lofty idea each morning. And every student in our school must begin the day by telling us what they will do that's going to be phenomenal that day. Once we mention that, that becomes our focus. Now we have to go out and do something that's wonderful and that's great.
That's a lot of pressure. I'm not sure I could start the day thinking about what I'm going to do that's
but
phenomenal.
But we do it with love. It's not with pressure or every student, and there's no punishment. If children misbehave, they have to write 100 reasons why they are too wonderful to do what they're doing. It's really done with love, and we tell every student in our school it is their right to be average, to be a failure, and that is one of their choices. But here is another way if you choose to partake of this.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with legendary educator Marva Collins. It's a Wisdom Watch conversation. You know, some kids have real problems. I mean, they have emotional problems or perhaps disabilities that do interfere with their ability to learn. How do you handle those situations?
I don't focus on the problems. Say, for example, I was in Oregon, and I was a 17-year-old. I had 700 students, and he was going to show me that I wasn't going to succeed. And, of course, as many black males do, he got this huge attitude. And I said, if you don't straighten that wonderful face, I'm going to come over and kiss you. I'm even going to marry you, and you're going to have the oldest wife in the world. And everyone is going to say, oh, that good-looking kid has an old wife. And he just broke into the biggest grin. And he said to me at the end of the session, you know, I wish you could be here every day. I'd like me when I'm with you.
It's interesting because I think if there is a rap on you, right, you know, and everybody who, you know, has a rap, the rap would be on the school. It would be a lot of memorization, heavy on the discipline. And what you're describing is a lot different. It's a very, what's the word I'm looking for, empathetic environment?
I personally rebel when people use negatives with me or when they threaten me. One can get me to do almost anything with reason, and I try to treat children with that same respect.
Where did that come from? I mean, were you raised that way, or was it something that
you determined to not do as a child?
I
think my parents would say to me, I can't believe someone as bright as you would have done that. And at times, I just wish they had hit me because that would really make me feel so badly. They would just shake their head and say, you know, I'm so sad right now. I just can't believe someone as bright as you would have done that.
What lesson do you draw from your incredible career? I mean, you've had, what, something like 40 honorary degrees, and you've been, you know, profiled by, you know, every major news program in the country that I can think of. But you've also had your critics, people who say that they don't like your methods. They feel that you know, you skim from the students. So what lesson do you draw from all this?
Well, actually, I don't pay attention to critics because we memorize one great poem every week. And one that comes to mind, it's not the critic that counts, but the man who's actually in the arena. Should he fail, he fails where daring greatly, so there'll never be among those timid souls that knows neither victory nor defeat. When we answer our critics, it means that we weren't sure of what we were doing in the first place. I know what it's like to see children's eyes holding wonder like a cup. I know what it's like to get these young people who are 7th and 8th grade and not reading. I know the joy that emanates in their faces. And that's all I need. But of all the honors and the accolades, I recently received a humanitarian award a few months ago from President Bush. And he said, you do such great work. I don't know why you don't take federal funding. And I said, Mr. President, with all due respect, my people never could have failed so miserably without the government's help.
What's so terrible about federal funding?
Well, I think the federal funding sets guidelines. There are no free rides, or he who rides the back of the tiger ends up inside his mouth. My guidelines are much higher than the ones set by the government and the states.
Well, it is said that you did take some federal funding through the CETA program. And for those who don't know, that's the Comprehensive What Education and Training
yes.
Administration programs. Is that not true?
That was naive at that time, and that happened for 9 or 10 months, and then I no longer took them. I believe the best thing people can do for us is really hands off. I'm an Ayn Rand aficionado, and I believe there are two kinds of people in the world, and that's the creator and the second hander. And creation comes before distribution, or there'll be nothing to distribute.
There's a lot more choice in education now than I think when you started your school. There's this whole charter school movement, and in some places you can get, you know, vouchers, government-funded vouchers, in order to attend the private school of your choice. Do you think kids are being served better in any way than they were when you got started?
You know, I would answer that by saying, if life is a bowl of cherries, why are we still in the pits? If these schools are so wonderful, then we have to ask, what are the results of these schools? The charter schools still happen to be public schools, just with a new name. It doesn't take a lot of money, despite what we've been told. You need a brilliant teacher. You think of Plato's The Academy. It wasn't about the junk and the things. It's having a mind there. It's leading children to great ideas. One of our students just made a perfect score, a black male on the west side of Chicago on the SAT exam. The one thing all students need is to be able to read, to write, to compute, and to think deductively and inductively, and to reason well, and to have discipline. I don't believe in punishment. I believe in discipline.
And you don't think, you know, you have no use for the whole ethnocentric curriculum idea.
No, well, I think we don't live in a world, I mean, we are multi-ethnically, there are all groups of people here. And when you major in Afrocentric studies, that's wonderful. But where do we find a job? I mean, I think of people who, whether we agree with whom she works for, we think of a Condoleezza Rice, who is universally bright wherever she goes. And that's what I want for our students, not just to be comfortable in their milieu, in their neighborhoods, but to be universally excellent. I don't want anyone giving me something because of the color of my skin. But there's no self-esteem like looking at anything, whether it's a house or whatever, and to say, I earned this.
What are you up to now?
I don't know what's next, but meanwhile, I just continue to prepare. If this is my last day on earth, I truly want to say I have completed the assignment that was given me on this earth, and I want to be sure that I have received a passing grade, not from someone else's perspective, but when I can look in the mirror and say, I like you, I admire you.
Yes, ma'am. Marva Collins is a longtime educator and the founder of the Marva Collins Preparatory Schools. She spoke with us from her home in Hilton Head, South Carolina. Marva Collins, thank you so much.
Oh, it was a real pleasure.